So this is going to be the answer to that question. Why target the SE handler if we can, if in order to do that, we already have to have overwritten the return pointer? The problem is that access violations will often occur. Think about where in the function you're getting the buffer overflow condition to occur. Maybe it's a function called X, and X has 100 lines of assembly in it. And in the 20th instruction out of 100 is the call to stir copy. That's when you get to overwrite the return pointer, right? You don't get control of the process then, but you've overwritten the return pointer. Another 80 lines of code or so needs to execute before you get that control via the ret instruction, right? So couldn't something in the code between the call to stir copy and the return screw things up or mess things up? Couldn't you have an access violation? And I put some assembly up on the screen to demonstrate that. What if you overwrite the buffer and you use A times whatever to get to that return pointer? And that all works properly. But then somewhere between the call to stir copy or whatever it is and the ret, you get those instructions. So let's read them. It says, move into EDI, dereference the stack pointer plus 8. So at the stack pointer plus 8 would probably be 41414141. So you've now loaded 41414141 into the EDI register. Then the next instruction says, test the value 8 against what EDI is pointing to. Well, what's EDI pointing to? 41414141. That's an invalid memory address, and therefore you're going to get an access violation. So even though you overwrote the return pointer, you never make it to the ret instruction, so therefore you can't get control that way. But what you can do is continue writing past the return pointer and overwrite the SE handler, because when that access violation occurs, guess what's going to happen? The exception handler is going to get called, and then you're going to get control because you overwrote that pointer. So more times than not, if you go and look up on ExploitDB as an example at the Windows buffer overflow vulnerabilities that have been discovered and exploits have been posted, you'll see that the majority of them are SEH overwrites because of this exact problem, where some code in between where you're getting the overwrite and when you get control via the ret instruction is causing an access violation. So hopefully that clears things up. So let's just go ahead and dive in here, and I'll show you what's going on. So I'm going to go back to my Windows 10 system, and it's still up on the screen, the stack overflow that we did via the return pointer overwrite. So I'm going to change this. I'll save it as Blaze 2 for now. You can name it whatever you want, but I'll save mine as blaze2.py. And up here, we'll create a file called blaze2.plf. I'm going to change the jump ESP variable to calling it SEH, but I'm just going to leave it alone for now. We don't have an address to use, and we're not even going to use that yet. So I'm just renaming it for now. Leave the shellcode in there, and let's get rid of the A times 260 and all of that. And we're going to change that back to being the pattern that we generated earlier. So let's go ahead and delete that. I'm going to go back to the file system to that pattern file that we generated earlier. So we go to Mona output, Blaze HTTV, pattern, grab that string again, and we're going to paste this in and save it and run it. So the shell code and the variable for SEH isn't being used. And now we're going to go and repeat our steps from earlier. Bring up Blaze, go to file open, but don't open it. Open playlist, click on Blaze 2, but don't open, and then bring up immunity like we did before. Attach to it. And when it comes up, we're simply going to open the file. So we click open, and let's see what happens. So that should look familiar. 37694136. If we take that and give that to Mona pattern offset, we get position found at 260. That's what we did before. But let's go back to the CPU window and scroll down the stack further. So I'm going to page down and page down. Now notice the pattern looks like it stops just above the SE handler. So you can do it one of two ways. We could generate a bigger pattern and paste that in and then see what portion of the pattern shows up, and we should get the answer that way, and that's what the book will have you do. But here it looks like we just came short, so 4 bytes, 8 bytes, 12 bytes, 16 bytes short of the SE handler before we were able to reach that. But just to make sure, because we might be wrong, let's just go ahead and go through creating a new pattern to verify that. So pattern create, I'll do 700 instead of 600. So it created it. Now we're going to kill the debugger. We'll go back over to the file system. You can see it made a pattern text.old and a new one. Let's grab the new pattern, which is going to be 700 bytes, and then replace the existing pattern with that pattern. So we'll run that, and then let's go ahead and repeat our steps. We'll go ahead and attach. And this time, when we look down the stack, we should see that next piece of the pattern. Okay, so the crash occurs like we expected. We see that first part of the pattern just like before. So we're scroll down now, and here's the SE handler. You can see we definitely overwrote it this time with 41347541. Now remember, the pointer to next SEH record is where it's supposed to point down the stack to the next handler position, right? And the SE handler below it, that's the one that points to what should be the DLL handler code. But we've overwritten that with a piece of the pattern now. So when I pass this exception with shift F9, we should see the instruction pointer go to that address, 41347541. So shift F9, and there we can see in the instruction pointer, 41347541. So exactly what we expected. We know how big the buffer is. So let's just grab that value and do the Mona PO, paste that in, and it says position 612. So 612 plus 4 bytes is going to be what overwrites that SE handler position. So we've got our answer. Now, just as a note, if you hit Shift F9 and it doesn't seem to be passing the exception, if you're on a Mac, for example, you may need to map in the key bindings. So let's now, since we found that, look at something. Actually, first, before we do that, let's change the script to being A times 612. Plus, we'll do what we did before, 90 times 20, and then we'll just add a shell code on the end. And we're not ready to exploit, but you know, we'll see this laid out the way we want. Let's run this, and then repeat our steps. All right, so when it attaches, we'll continue and let it crash. Now, it's going to crash because the return pointer overwrite. We expect that. So we get the AAAA in the instruction pointer. But now if we scroll down where the stack pointer is currently pointing, we can see we overwrote the SE handler with 90909090. And so we're right at the beginning. We're where we expect it to be. We could have put a fake return pointer or pointer in there or whatever, but like dead code, but this is fine. We can see that those first set of knobs are overwriting the handler. So if I hit Shift F9, we should get 90909090. And we do. Now, here's the important part to understand about this technique, because so far it's been real similar to the prior. If you let the process crash because it thinks it's calling an exception handler, right? That's where we got the 90909090. What we have on the screen in the stack is something called the establisher frame. Now, the rule, it's been this way ever since old Windows, and it's still the way it is today on 32-bit processes when exception handlers are running. At the stack pointer, during what it thinks is the call to the exception handler, plus 8 is the callback pointer. Remember, if the first handler can't point or can't handle the exception, it needs to walk the list, the NSEH pointer, to the next handler on the stack, right? So at ESP plus 8 is where it gets the pointer on the stack to NSEH. So if we right-click on that and say follow in stack, look where we are. We're back right there at the NSEH pointer above our knobs. So that's really interesting, because this is going to what ends up getting us control. What we want to do, and I'll go back to where the stack pointer is currently pointing, we want to overwrite the handler, not with those nine zeros or dead code or anything. We want to overwrite it with the address of the code sequence pop pop ret. What that's going to do is pop the first double word off the stack. Then it's going to pop the second double word off the stack, and then we're going to return to the address on the stack where NSEH is located, but we're going to execute what's there. So we're going to return, pop, pop, return to the address of the stack where NSEH is stored, and we're going to ret to that address. So we're going to execute whatever's there as code. So if that's the case, if we right click on this and say follow in stack, we would then execute AAAA, which is increment ECX, increment ECX. So let's go and find the address of a pop pop rep, and we'll overwrite the SE handler with that, and we'll see where we get. So I'm going to say Mona SEH, and then minus module configuration dot DLL. Now this might take a moment to run, because again, it's going through all the executable code and looking for pop pop rep sequences. It's still hanging. There, okay, it's done. We click on the log window. You can see found a total of 444 pointers. So that's a ton. And any of these should be good. Now notice some of them say pop pop ret 8, pop pop ret 4, and you'll see other ones as well. Remember what that ret with a value does. It returns to whatever the stack pointer is pointing to, but then instead of the stack pointer just adjusting down to the next double word in this case, it adjusts it 4 bytes further or 8 bytes further and so on and so forth. So I don't really care about that right now, but it's something to consider. I'm going to grab this top hit here, and we'll right click and say copy the address to the clipboard, and we'll close this down. And I'm going to change this SEH variable here to that address. And we'll save that. Now we're going to, at A times 612, we're going to put in that variable. So SEH plus the NOPS. So we're pushing the NOPS down by 4 because we want to, right? We want to overwrite the SE handler with the pop-pop ret address. So let's see where this gets us visually in the debugger. We'll save that, we'll run it, and repeat the steps from earlier. So just waiting for it to come up here. Okay, we'll set a breakpoint now on that address. So Control G, paste that address in. Didn't take us there. Do it again, Control G. And there's the pop ECX ret. So we hit F2 to set the breakpoint, and we'll go over and let it run. So we hit the access violation because we overwrote the return pointer. And if we scroll down the stack, we can see we overwrote the SE handler with the address of the pop-pop ret. So let's hit F9 to continue, or actually shift F9 to pass the exception. And we reach the breakpoint at the pop-pop ret. What that's going to do again, at the stack, during this call of what it thinks is the exception handler, the stack pointer plus 8 is the callback pointer to NSEH. So that's why we're popping this first one off the stack, popping the second one, and returning to the third one. So let's let it happen. So stepping, pop, pop, ret. Now we just ret back down to the NSEH position, and we're executing those A's as if they're instructions. So it says increment ECX, increment ECX, and those won't hurt anything. But watch what happens when we get down to what was the SEH address. When it tries to execute that, if you look at the bottom, it says access violation when reading 90906033. That's an invalid memory address. So it's trying to interpret the address we used as opcodes, and that address is hurting it. Now, sometimes we get lucky, and that address may not actually cause any problems. We might be able to get past it to our NOPS sled, to our shell code, but in this case, we can't. We can fix this, though, by changing the first two bytes of the NSEH position with the values EB06. And what that will do is say jump short 6 bytes, jumping over the SEH address to the NOPS sled. So we're just jumping over what's hurting us, and then we're sliding down to our shell code. So that should fix our problem. So let's go ahead and do that. So in order to do that, we need to back off 4A. So we'll go from 612 to 608, so we get to the NSEH position, plus hex EB, hex 06, pad pad. Now, EB06. So EB is jump short. 06 means 6 bytes. That's the operand. We put the AA just so we pad it out to the full double word to take up the whole NSEH field, right? And then that should make it so we jump over the SEH address to the NOPS sled. So let's save that and run it and bring it back up in the debugger again. All right, so open playlist, bring up the debugger. And we'll just go in and set the breakpoint again here as soon as it comes up. All right, so let's let it run. So we hit the access violation, do the return pointer overwrite, and obviously outside of debugger, this exception wouldn't get caught. Like the debugger's job is to catch this, so it would just run. And I'll show you that as well. So we hit Shift F9, and we hit the breakpoint. So this time, we do a pop, and we return. Now we return to a jump short 6 bytes. So it shows we're going to jump to 0019F2CC, and if we take that jump, we jump right over to our nops, and we hit our nops sled. And if we let this continue, we'll get a shell. So let's run this outside of the debugger to verify. And there's a funny thing about this one. When the exception handler gets called, or our fake exception handler, actually I don't need a debugger, it detects an exception because, you know, when it spawns a shell, it just doesn't end gracefully and it ends up calling the exception handler a second time. So it's kind of like one of those, value driven exploits where if you open up the playlist, you get 2 shells for the same price of 1 shell. So pretty amusing. I've actually seen it before where not this program, but another one gets stuck in a loop and it just keeps calling the exception handler over and over again and just basically fork bombing yourself with shells. So pretty amusing. But that technique should be pretty clear. Again, as usual, the instructions are going to go into more detail and the notes below them. So work your way through that and hopefully everything comes clear if there's any confusion there. And let's jump back out to the slide here just to go to the end of this module. There we go. So the point of that one for this module in all is to do the stack overflow, overwrite the return pointer, get control that way, and then look at it where if there's an access violation occurring and you never make it to the epilogue and to the RET instruction, then go and overwrite the SE handler if it's possible. Now, another cool thing is, what if there was a stack canary, a security cookie protecting it? If you cause an access violation prior to reaching the epilogue, because you would have overwritten the canary, maybe, depending on the operating system version, you can skip the canary check by causing an access violation and having overwritten the SEH handler pointer. So pretty cool opportunity there. We also had to get around ASLR by avoiding it through the static modules. We got around safe SEH protection because some of those modules weren't compiled to use it. So at this point, this is the end of the module, and we're going to move on here in a moment to dealing with hardware DEP instead of safe SEH or other controls. Moving on to defeating hardware DEP with ROP will be our next step. So in this module, it's broken up into two and a half primary pieces. The first one, I always debate whether or not I should remove this from the course or leave it in, but I leave it in because it's just a demo walkthrough, and it's really good to see kind of how the exploitation process evolved in regard to disabling data execution prevention or changing permissions. So the first thing we're going to do is take you through a demo of how it used to be done up until Windows 7, and then we'll quickly move into return-oriented programming. So, and I'm going to show you a couple differences there, different options there, and we'll look at both an older version and the version on Windows 10 that you'll be using in this book. So our objectives for this module, I just pretty much went over that, so let's go forward. So software DEP is another name for safe SEH that we already defeated by just simply avoiding it. It wasn't a good control, and I don't know why they called it software DEP, but I think that's a terrible name. Hardware DEP, though, is what we care about now. This has to be supported by the processor. We know it marks pages of memory as writable or executable. You can't be both, and it's going to be more difficult to defeat. So most companies, whatever the default that Microsoft sets on Windows, is they'll leave it at that. And I've seen it before where even newer versions of Windows, for whatever reason, come out of the box with DEP disabled by default. Now, by disabled, it's still enabled for essential Windows programs and services, but any third-party application you install, it's not going to protect it. As we saw already on our Windows 10 system, DEP is enabled by default for everything, and we put an exception in for the Blaze application, which we're going to remove here soon. So several techniques discovered to defeat hardware DEP or avoid it. One is potentially return to libc by sticking with executable sections of code or memory. Then we don't have to worry about changing permissions. disabling depth with trampolines, with these simple gadgets. That's what I'm going to demo here soon. And then ROP is what we'll focus on for the majority of this module. Most of it, as you've seen already, we have to rely on DLLs, and we either have to find static DLLs that have been non-rebased, or we have to find a memory leak or something like that. So what's our next step? Hardware depth is going to prevent our old attack from being successful. I'm going to first do that walkthrough I talked about, and this technique was discovered by Scape and Skywing, both of which work at Microsoft, or I'm not sure if Skywing still does, but he did. And they discovered that when XP Service Pack 2 came out, there was a new routine in NTDLL that checked an application to see whether or not it was compiled and wants to participate in DEP or not. And you used to be able to turn DEP on or off for the whole process, which is kind of crazy. So what they discovered is there's a routine called LDRP check NX, so NX bit compatibility, and it checks the metadata in the binary to see if DEP should be turned on or off. And there's a flag in there. It's a process executes flag, and it's either going to be 1, 2, or 8. So depending on what the flag is, governs whether or not DEP gets turned on for the process or it gets left off for the process. So in theory, if we could control the instruction pointer of a process that has DEP running, if we replay code changing the flag, then we should be able to turn DEP off for the process while it's live, which is kind of crazy. And that's why they deprecated that mitigation class known as application optional. So the remainder of this, or the next set of slides here, it does the walkthrough in case you wanted to try and replicate this at home. It's not a requirement in the course. It's not an exercise. I'm simply going to demo it now, but the slides are set up so you can walk back through that if you choose to do so. What we're going to do is go over to, we're going to use Kali, and we're going to use our XP Service Pack 2 system that I've got up here. So you can take a moment and look at XP in all its glory. Remember the easy days. Either way, we've got this FTP process up and running, War FTP. So I'm going to kill the process, and we're going to see whether or not DEP is on or off currently on this system. So I'll bring up my system control panel, and we'll jump to advanced performance DEP. And right now you can see that War FTP is listed as an exception. So DEP is not turned on for this process. And we're going to leave it that way for now to see if our exploit works. So we'll go ahead and bring up War FTP, put it online. The IP address here is 10.10.10.30, and I'll see if I can reach it. So FTP 10.10.10.30, and I can't get there. Let me see if my IP address got lost. And I lost my IP, so let me go see what I set in Metasploit. 10.10.12.12 is what I want to be. So, okay, so now let's try the FTP. Okay, now I can FTP there. You see, I'm able to reach the FTP server, so we're good. Back over here, I just ran the set command. I already set my options. My remote host is 10.10.10.30, which is the Windows box. Remote port, we've got my local host at 10.10.12.12. You can see I'm using a reverse TCP meterpreter payload, and my target number is 3 for that particular version of Windows. So we'll say exploit right now, and you can see we got in. So that's how easy it used to be anyway. You could just get into a box, super simple, right? So we got in, it works. I'm going to drop out of here and leave this up. Now we're going to go back over and turn on DEP to make it harder. So we bring up system control panel again, advanced performance, and we remove the exception. Apply, okay. This time, when we run the attack, it should fail. So let's go back over to Metasploit, exploit, and you can see it did not work. So let's go look at Windows. And there is the DEP warning message. It says data execution prevention. To help protect your computer, Windows has closed this program. The funny part about this is it has change settings right up there. Like, we just protected you from an exploit. Would you like to change your settings and make yourself vulnerable? No, so we'll leave that off. But you can see it crashed. Send that error report to Microsoft. And DEP is on. So we see what we're up against now. So I'm going to go ahead and quickly demo that technique that the book walks you through just to show you how easy it used to be to get around these application optional controls at times. So to do this, I'm going to bring up Immunity Debugger. And we're going to bring up WarFTP. Let's put it online. And what I'm going to do is go to executable modules and jump to ntdll.dll, because that's where that runtime code was loaded, as indicated by Scape and Skywing. So over here in the disassembler pane, I'm going to control S. And the first thing we need to do is make sure that we set the flag, or we set the accumulator register to 1. So we want to find an instruction that says move 1 into AL and then return. So move AL 1 followed by rep 4, I believe is the one that's available. And you can see we find it, 7C952080. So I'm going to go ahead and grab that line. We're going to go over to Kali. And we're going to go into the module. So here I've got the Metasploit module location up on the screen. So Vim, WarFTP, user, and we're inside. So here's the buffer input. It says A times 485 or whatever, something times 485. And then we overwrite the return pointer. So the buffer is 485 bytes to get to the return pointer. It's an odd number, but whatever. So I'm going to go ahead and paste in now my location and memory from the Windows box, and just as a comment right now. So I needed that one. Let's go back over to Windows. Control S. Now we need to find this instruction that indicates the beginning of that routine that's going to replay the code to turn off dep. And that's going to be a compare AL to 1, followed by a push 2, followed by a pop ESI. And we find that at this address. Remember, this is XP, so there's no ASLR. So we'll copy that to the clipboard. We'll go back over to Kali and we'll insert, Visual GDB. So we'll just insert this. And we've got everything we need now. So we need to modify this buffer, and I'm going to explain in more detail here once I can show you in a debugger. But here we'll say change the buffer size to 100, and we're going to copy this code here. So we're going to push the return pointer overwrite back, and we're first going to execute those little gadgets that we just found in the debugger. So in here, I'm going to say 0x7C952080, and that's the top memory address we copied over, dot pack, and then V, we'll put it in a millennium format, plus A times 4, because we have to compensate for that ret 4 that you saw, plus, same thing again, but this time the other address. So 0x7C91D3F8. So in other words, after we do the move 1 into AL, we're going to return to that other set of code that we saw. So F8 dot pack and A times 88. The reason A times 88 is because with this particular vulnerability, that's the difference of where the stack pointer was from the actual buffer, the control buffer that we care about. So you can look in the debugger and see what that's there. But that's not something that's going to be consistent. It's going to be different with each particular vulnerability. So now we've got that in there, and I'm going to save this. So WQ, we're out. Then we go back over to Metasploit here. I'm going to say reload. So it reloads the module. Go over to XP. We're going to kill this process out in the debugger. We open it up outside the debugger and it's running. And let's see if we got this to work and we disable dep. And as you can see, it worked. So we got around dep that easily. That is why they deprecated that particular category. I mean, that's just ridiculous that you can replay some simple code. Would it take us less than 5 minutes to do it and gain execution? So let me quit out of here. And I'm going to run the exploit again, but this time we will follow what's happening in the debugger. So let's bring up the debugger. All right, it's online. Everything's good. Well, let's put it online. And we're going to set a breakpoint on what we're overwriting the return pointer with. So back to ntdll, control S, move into AL 0x1, followed by a ret 4. And there's that address again. We set the breakpoint there, and now we launch the exploit. All right. So we hit the breakpoint, as you can see, and we're moving 1 into AL. Now, in this case, we just got lucky, and EAX already had 1 in it. So that's just luck. So we need to make sure there's a 1 in AL, so that's why we execute this first. And you'll see why in a moment. So let's let that happen. And then we rep 4 to the next code sequence, which should look familiar. Compare AL to 1. We need this comparison to be true, and that's why we set AL to 1. So when this occurs, look at the 0 flag down here. That's going to get set to 1. So I stepped the instruction. 0 flag got set to 1 because comparison is true. And then push 2 onto the stack down here. There's the 2, and then we pop it into ESI. Now ESI holds the 2. And that's going to end up being the process executes flag we want to go and turn dep off. That's why we did that. Then it says jump if equal. Well, we were equal because AL was equal to 1. So we take the jump. Then we move to the stack pointer, or to the base pointer minus 4, the 2 that we put in ESI. So that's written onto the stack. Mandatory jump. Then we're comparing EBP minus 4 where the 2 is located to 0. That's going to be false. So the 0 flag is now going to get turned off. And it's off. Jump if not 0, well, it wasn't 0, so we're going to take the jump. Then push 4 onto the stack. Load the effective address into EAX of the 2 from the stack. So the address of the 2 is now in the accumulator register. Then we push it onto the stack. We push 22 hex on the stack. We push a negative 1 onto the stack. And now we're calling ZW set information process, which is going to turn dep off. And you can see all the arguments are ready to go. So that's all it's doing. We hit go, and actually I'll show you something else real quick. I'm following through by single stepping, and we're in NTDLL. We get to the sysenter instruction. That is the instruction that's going to take us into the kernel in ring 0, but this is a ring 3 debugger. So right now dep is on. If I hit F7, we're still in NTDLL because we just came out of the kernel and it disabled dep for us. And now it's going to return back and do the whole jump ESP and execute the interpreter payload. So that's how that thing worked. No need to go any further there, but it's pretty fascinating that it was that easy back at that time. So let me just jump through to the end of this walkthrough. All right, so the technique we just covered, as you saw, was quite simple considering how fast we were able to get through it. Now, if that's the first time you're seeing it, it may look like, whoa, that was crazy, and it is, but look at how easy that was, or how quickly you could do it if you know the technique, versus what we're about to get into, which is return-oriented programming. And that's a nice segue, because we did have to return back to a couple sequences of code and do some code reuse, right, in order to get it to turn off. So ROP is very similar to that, but we're going to need a lot more gadgets, a lot more code sequences to set up the arguments to call a critical function to change permissions in memory, because we can't turn dep off for the whole process anymore. So I'm going to do two walkthroughs here. One of them is going to be on that same XP image that I just showed you, since I have it up, and I can show you one technique for doing ROP on that one, and instead of doing the turn off dep for the whole process, we're going to change permissions in memory. And then we're going to shift over to Windows 10, and I'll show you the other example that you'll be doing in a lab coming up, which is by putting the arguments that we need into registers and then using a instruction called push AD, but we'll hold off on that for now. So we just covered that technique by Scape and Skywing. Let's use ROP. So functions that can disable dep, I grabbed this list here from Corland Coder's website, corland.be. These are 6 of the most common critical functions that people use to either disable dep, if you could, on that particular operating system, or on something like Windows 10, change permissions in memory where your shell code resides. Virtual alloc and virtual protect are 2 of the most common ways to do it. The difference is virtual protect only allows you to change permissions at a certain location in memory, where virtual alloc allows you to allocate memory and set the permissions. So we're going to use virtual protect in our techniques, but you can also use virtual alloc. And the reason for that is if you give virtual alloc the address of an existing allocated block of memory and you change the permission value, it won't try to reallocate the memory. It'll simply recognize, oh, this memory is already allocated, but clearly you want to change the permission. So that's why you're able to use both. Heap create is similar to virtual alloc, but it's going to require more code. And then write process memory, you can write to any location in memory and then mark it, you know, it's already executable if you write it to a code segment. And then finally, set process dep policy and NT set information process. Those 2 are the deprecated ones. We just saw NT send information process in that demo I walked through previously. So that we can't use those anymore. So the two in the middle, just ignore those unless you're on an older operating system. So one question, won't Canary stop return-oriented programming? Since we rely on return pointers a lot of times with return-oriented programming, not return pointers, but the return instruction a lot with this, wouldn't a Canary prevent you from doing it? Now, if you're relying on a return pointer overwrite to kick off this whole exploitation process and there's a Canary there, then yeah, certainly it's going to pose a challenge. You might be able to do that trick I mentioned earlier, which is if you can cause an access violation prior to getting to the RET instruction and you overwrite a SE handler address, you might be able to do it that way. You might be able to utilize a heap overflow or heap exploit where there's not a Canary, or maybe the particular function isn't protected by Canary. So it depends, right? There's different ways you would look at it. And we talked about ways of defeating Canaries when possible as well. So virtual protect is the function or critical function that we're going to use to change permissions in memory. And you see up on the screen the arguments that are needed for virtual protect. Now, first off, we need the address of the virtual protect function to begin with. And on the XP example, I'll show you that's easy because it's static. On the Windows 10 example, it's going to be a little more of a clever technique we have to utilize. So we'll get there soon. But the arguments needed, aside from the return pointer. So one thing to point out, when we're doing return-oriented programming, we're not going to call virtual protect. We're going to ret to it. And remember, the call instruction always pushes the return pointer onto the stack first. So we have to compensate for that. So aside from these four arguments you see, we need to put the return pointer first, and then we go to LP address, DW size, new protect, and old protect. We'll get back to that, though. So the arguments that virtual protect needs, LP address, it needs to be a pointer to the address in memory where you wish to change permissions. In other words, the address of your shell code is what you want to put there. DW size is the size of your shell code. You don't want to get too greedy here. You don't want to give it such a large size where it goes out of bound of a particular segment or stack in memory. So we want to give it this size as close as possible of the shell code. New protect is going to be the permission that we wish to change to. So in this case, if you look at MSDM, read, write, execute is hex 40. But this is a double word, so we need it to say 00000040. And then finally, old protect. This needs to be a pointer to a writable area in memory where it can write the old permission value that you've now changed to 40. So those are the arguments we need to set up. And one thing to point out, you might say, well, can't we just write these arguments as is with our attack? Probably not, because you can't write null bytes in a lot of cases. If you can, great. But a lot of times you can't. So when you can't, you're going to have to use ROP gadgets to write those values for you to compensate for the nulls. And we'll get there here shortly. So let's walk through how this technique's going to work, and then I'll demo it and walk through that example. So what you see on the screen here at the top is it says buffer, and you see 41414141. Just assume that's the end of the buffer before you get to the frame pointer. And then we get the frame pointer, and then we overwrite the return pointer. That's where we get control, right? When we ret to that, whatever we put there. So the neat thing about this style, because this style is going to be different than the one we walk through in Windows 10. Now you can use either of these, but this is the one I've got set up to show you on the XP VM. With this one, we are going to write the arguments to virtual protect one at a time. So if you look down a bit, you see virtual protect, then return pointer to virtual protect, then arg, 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 arg. And those arguments are what we need to be the address of our shell code, the size, the new protect option of 40, and the pointer to writable memory where it can write the old one. But let's assume we can't write null bytes. So we can't just write 00000040 for the protect option. We've got to get code to do it for us. So what we want to do with this first gadget is preserve the address of the stack pointer at that moment in time, because we don't know where we will be in memory on the target's system. We don't know where in virtual memory this particular stack is located. So we don't want to have to care about that, and we want to remain relative. So we want to factor in position independence and only focus on where we do the writes for the arguments to virtual protect based on relative offsets from where the stack pointer was at this moment in time or is in this moment in time. And I know that may sound weird, but it'll come clear. Right now, the stack pointer points to the return pointer, and assume we're about to ret. When we ret to that address, the stack pointer is going to go down 4 bytes, right? So by preserving where the stack pointer is pointing at that moment in time, when we do our writes for the arguments to virtual protect, we can say write to the preserved stack pointer address plus 16, plus 20, plus 24. And again, we're position independent and we're writing to relative offsets from where the stack pointer was pointing at the moment in time when we first got control. And this will become clear moving forward. If you want to just kind of do a TLDR high level recap, we are preserving whatever address the stack pointer is pointing to at this moment in time as a first step. And that's what the code in the bottom right is doing. It's saying move into EDI, the address of the stack pointer, and then ret to the next gadget. That means that EDI and ESP should both hold that preserved stack pointer address. Because it's about to change with the stack pointer, right? The stack pointer is going to keep going down the stack as we execute our gadget code. But that's okay because we kept a copy of that in EDI and we can write to the relative offset from that position. So next gadget is we don't want to modify any of our placeholder arguments. We've got the address of virtual protect, the return pointer of virtual protect, the LP address size protections. We want to leave that alone because we have not yet written the arguments to virtual protect. In this case, since it's XP, we can write the address of virtual protect from NTDLL as part of our attack buffer input. But right now, we're just simply going to add some number of bytes to the stack pointer to adjust it down past our placeholder argument positions to the next gadget. And we've done that. Next up, the next thing we want to do is, and this is a tricky part, we need to load the address of the shell code into the accumulator register. So look at the bottom right. The first instruction says move into EAX, the preserved stack pointer address from earlier, right? So at this moment in time, EAX and EDI would both hold that preserved stack pointer address from earlier. Then we're adding hex 100 to the accumulator register. That's going to put into EAX the offset from the preserved stack pointer to our shell code. And I'll show you this in the debugger soon. And you may say, well, how do we know that it's plus 100 hex? How do we know that's where our shell code is? Because you're the one that controls the buffer layout. You're the one that sent the A times whatever it is to get to the return pointer. You're the one that put in the ROP chain. So you know how many bytes from that preserved stack pointer gadget your shell code would be. So it may not always be 100, but in this case it will be, and I'll show this to you in a debugger soon. But in any case, EAX now points to our shell code. And now that EAX points to our shell code, we want to write that as the argument for virtual protect. Remember, we need to give it the address of our shell code, so that's where it changes permissions. We also would put that same address in the return pointer position, and I'll walk you through this on the debugger here soon. So what do we do? We preserve the stack pointer as soon as we got control so that we can write relative offsets from that position. Then we executed a gadget that caused the stack pointer to jump down past our placeholder arguments for virtual protect. Then we took the preserved stack pointer address and we loaded it into EAX and we added hex 100 so that EAX points to our shell code. And finally here, we write the address of our shell code to the appropriate offset from the preserved stack pointer. So look what the code says. Move into EDI plus 0C. EDI is the preserved stack pointer address plus 0C from that location is where the LP address argument is. And we're writing to that location the shell code. So pretty neat. And we just continue doing this to write all the arguments as I'll show soon. One final thing to point out though, because this is very common. I joke when I'm live in the classroom a lot and I say, how many of you in this room are perfect? And without fail, one or two people always raise their hand, which is hysterical that it's always one or two people. But either way, most of us aren't perfect, right? We've got, what's a nice way of saying, we've got annoying characteristics or personality traits. And we're pretty much all guilty of that to some degree. You can probably ask your roommates or your family members or spouse or whoever that. So let's say, I'll just use a silly example here off the top of my head. Let's say someone never cleans up the dishes after they eat. So they eat food and they leave all the dirty dishes out in the kitchen. And then you go into the kitchen and you're like, oh man, now I have to clean up again after this person who never cleans up after themselves. Like that's annoying, right? Now, or you may be the person that does that. So either way, you get the point. And if you have a roommate that does that, is that enough for you to say, I can't be roommates with that person anymore? Is it such a bad trait that you're going to just say, I'm calling it, like, we can't live together anymore? Or is that something that you're willing to tolerate? Now, that analogy kind of applies here to the gadget world. Remember what a gadget is. It's a sequence of code that we found somewhere in executable memory that does what we need it to do and ends with a return or a jump instruction, allowing us to maintain control. Those code sequences may not be perfect. Look at the code sequence on the right here. It says move into EDI ESP. That's what we want to happen to preserve the stack pointer. Then we just want a return, but we might not be able to find that code sequence exactly as we'd like. Maybe we find that code sequence, but before we get to the RET instruction, there's a pop ESI. Now, that may or may not be problematic. If ESI has no use to us at this point in time, then we can just put 4 bytes on the stack so that the stack pointer pops that off, or it gets popped off where the stack pointer is pointing, and we just pop like AAAA into ESI, and then we return to the next gadget address. And I'll show you this on a slide in a moment. But what if instead of saying pop ESI in this example, it said pop EDI? So move into EDI ESP, pop EDI RET. That's going to destroy our register. It's going to override it with something that we don't want. So that would be an example of an instruction that we can't tolerate. And here's an example on the slide that says, okay, let's compensate for that unwanted instruction. So we have our preserve ESP gadget. When we RET to that address, the stack pointer, as you can see on the right, now points to 41414141. That's by design, because look to the right, we're moving the stack pointer address into EDI, and then we're going to slide down and pop that 41414141 off the stack into ESI. The stack pointer would adjust down, and we'd RET to the next gadget accordingly. If we didn't put the padding bytes in there, when we did the pop ESI, we would pop the next gadget address off the stack into ESI and return out of order. So hopefully that clarifies things. Some gadgets will have unwanted instructions that you can tolerate, other ones will not. And you got to go dig for ones that are better for you. Okay, so let's jump over to the demo, and then we'll move to Windows 10. Now, what I'm going to do here, this exploit goes against the WarFTP vulnerability. So I'm going to start up, and we haven't put DEP back off or anything. DEP is still on. So we'll bring up WarFTP again. And I'm going to go to my other folder here, my Python folder. Give me a moment. And I'm going to click on the exploit. So it's called warftp.py. I double click it and watch. Nothing happens, right? And the FTP server is still on in the background. But watch now. Netstat minus NA more. Port 4444 is now open. So it works. We were able to disable DEP through ROP. Now let me kill this FTP server. And the port should be closed now. And now you can see the port's closed. So the exploit does work. One more time, we run WarFTP. We double click the exploit. And the port is now open. So it works great. So let's go ahead and kill that and see what's going on inside the debugger. First off, I'm going to bring up the exploit. Now you can see a lot of comments in here, and what you see on the left, that's the ROP chain. So it's quite a few lines, as you can see. It's because it's doing all those things that we just talked about. At the very top, you can see we're preserving the stack pointer, and then we're adjusting the stack pointer. Then it's our placeholder. So we've got the static address of virtual protect that'll be written, and then a bunch of padding bytes for our placeholders to for the arguments. And then below that is going to be our true ROP chain that writes all the values we need to the offsets accordingly. So now let's watch this execute. I'm going to grab the address of the first gadget that's going to preserve the stack pointer, and we'll set that as a breakpoint in the debugger. So let's bring up the debugger, bring up the FTP server, put it online, and I'll go to the address. So we got to the address, I'm going to set the breakpoint. Now let's go run the exploit. So we run it, and breakpoint hit in the debugger. So we've reached the breakpoint, and you can see the instruction we're about to execute is increment EDX. Now look down in the stack pane towards the bottom on the right, in the middle to the right. If I scroll up a little bit, you can see all the A's getting down to the address we're currently at, the 76D4. That was the return pointer overwrite. And the stack pointer now is currently pointing to the next gadget we want to go to. Below that a little bit, you can see the virtual protect address and then our placeholders. And then below that is the ROP chain. And below that, you see a short, more A's and then followed by the shell code. So we'll hold off on that. We'll get there soon. So let's let this first instruction execute. Increment EDX, that's an unwanted instruction. I could have changed the address from 76D4 to 76D5, and it wouldn't cause issue. I generated this ROP chain many years ago with Mona, and it's better than it was today, it's better now than it was then. So let's let it execute. Push ESP, this is where we're pushing the stack pointer at this moment in time onto the stack. Then we have an unwanted instruction that doesn't hurt anything, and then we pop the stack pointer off the stack into the EDI register. We have now preserved it. If you look at ESP and EDI right now, they're both pointing to the same address, and that's exactly what we wanted to do. And now we're going to return to the next gadget. The next gadget says push EDI onto the stack, which is to preserve stack pointer address, because now ESP has moved on. We push it on the stack, we pop it into EAX. So now EAX and EDI both hold the preserved stack pointer address. Then comes an unwanted instruction, pop EBP. And that's why I've got the 41414141 on the stack there to compensate as padding, so that gets popped into EBP. Then we ret to the next gadget. The next gadget, there's an unwanted instruction there. We probably could have adjusted it another byte forward and skipped this part, but either way, I put 4 bytes of padding on the stack. That gets popped into ESI. Then we add 32 bytes, or hex 20, to the stack pointer. Before we let that execute, look where the stack pointer is pointing on the stack on the bottom right. It's pointing to the address of virtual protect. We want the stack pointer to point there at some point, but we haven't written our arguments below, as you see, yet. So by adjusting the stack pointer by 32 bytes, it's going to point to the next gadget and not mess up our placeholders there. So let's let that happen. Now the stack pointer points to the next gadget. We've got our ret 4, so that's why you see some padding bytes below the address we're returning to. And now, as I mentioned on the slide earlier, we're adding hex 100 to the preserved stack pointer address in EAX. So EAX now points to A5FE48, and the preserved stack pointer address is A5FD48. So if we look at what EAX is pointing to by right-clicking on it and say follow in stack, it points to the start of our shell code. And again, we know how far away our shell code was from the gadget where we preserve the stack pointer, because we control the buffer. So we can set that to whatever we want. So the next thing we're going to do, pop EBP, unwanted instructions, so there were another 4 A's on the stack, and then we return to the next gadget. Now we're at the point where we want to start writing gadgets here shortly. Like, I'm not writing gadgets, but writing the arguments to the stack. So first thing we're doing here is preserving a stack pointer again. We always want to maintain control of that preserved stack pointer address, because that's how we're calculating the offsets to where we're writing the arguments. So we preserve it. Unwanted instruction is decrementing ECX. Return 0C, so that's where we've got a bunch of padding down there. Ret. And here's our first write. We're writing the address of the shell code in EAX to the preserved stack pointer address stored in ESI plus 20 bytes. So let's go look at ESI. Right click, follow in stack, ESI plus 20. So if we go down 4, 8, 12, 16, 20, that's the position of the return pointer to Virtual Protect once Virtual Protect wraps up. So when Virtual Protect is done, it's going to return to the address of our shellcode that we're going to write there right now. So I just wrote it. So let's go up and take a look and see if it did it. And here you can see the Virtual Protect address. And now we overwrote where it said RETN with the address of the shellcode. We then need to write the address of the shellcode again to the next double word down, because that's the LP, the pointer, I should say, to the shellcode where we're going to change permissions. So unfortunately, there's an unwanted instruction here that moves the preserved stack pointer address from ESI into EAX, overwriting the address of the shellcode. So we're now 100 hex off again. Unwanted instruction, return. We're pushing EAX on the stack, which is preserved stack pointer, because we just clobbered it in ESI, pop it into ESI. So now we've got that address preserved at multiple locations. And then we're going to return. We're going to add hex 100 to EAX again. So we're replaying that old code so that it has the address of our shell code there again. Unwanted instruction, ret. And now we're writing offset 24 from the preserved stack pointer so that we write the destination address of our shell code as the argument for virtual protect. So we let that happen, and then we'll scroll up on the stack. And you can see we wrote it again. So now we've got the return pointer written and the address of our shell code for the argument to virtual protect. Next up, we need to write the size. So let's let that happen. Unwanted instruction, return. We're zeroing out the accumulator register, so it's zeroed. And then we're adding 100 to EAX. That's going to serve as our size argument. So now EAX holds 100. We pop off the stack some garbage into BP, return. We're preserving the stack pointer again, unwanted instruction, ret0c, and now we're doing the write of the size argument. This goes back to that thing I was mentioning where we can't write 00000100 natively. We've got to have, because it's a null bytes, we've got to have a gadget do it for us. So we write that. Let's go verify that it worked. And you can see we wrote the size argument. Next up, we need to write hex 40. So pretty much the same thing. Let's zero out the accumulator register after preserving the stack pointer. Then let's add hex 40, which serves as the read, write, execute permissions argument into EAX. Unwanted instruction, ret. And now we're writing the permissions to offset 32 from the preserved stack pointer. Let's go verify. And as you can see, we've got all of our arguments set up to virtual protect. We were able to write the last one in as is because it's a full address with no null bytes, and it just needs to be any writable address in memory so it can write the old protection value. And to get that address, we could just go to the memory map and look for anything that's static with read, write, execute. So with everything set up, we just need to get the stack pointer now to point up to where the virtual protect address is and return to it. And that's what we're going to do. We're moving the preserved stack pointer address into EAX from EDI. Then we have two unwanted instructions. Then we return to the next gadget. It says add 16 bytes to the preserved stack pointer address. That's going to point us to virtual protect on the stack. So let's let that happen. Let's look and see what EAX is pointing to. And as you can see, EAX points to virtual protect. We just need the stack pointer to point there. So next thing, move the address of virtual protect, the stack position where virtual protect is stored into EDI. Then we move it into ESP. So look at ESP now on the bottom right, and now look at it. It points right to virtual protect. We're going to ret to it, and now we're in kernel 32, and you can see all the arguments are set up on the stack. We'd sysenter, change permissions, let it execute with F9, and then the port's going to be open. Now you can see 4444 is open. We close the debugger, and now you can see 4444 is closed. So pretty neat, right? A lot more work than the last technique, but this one works today on Windows. Now let's get off of Windows XP and move on to Windows 10 here. All right, so now let's take a look at a Windows 10 example. We're going to do two things at once here. One is we're going to look at a different way of generating a ROP chain versus the prior way. The prior way, we wrote one argument onto the stack at a time, and that was based on the relative offset from the preserved stack pointer. In this example, we're going to put our arguments to Virtual Protect into processor registers and then write them all onto the stack at once using an instruction called pushAD. And we'll also again be on Windows 10, your Windows 10 VM for this one. So one thing to mention is stack pivoting. And there's two primary types of pivots, at least from my understanding or in my world. One is a common one used during exploitation that involves the heap, such as USAPT or free, where you need to exchange the stack pointer with something like the accumulator register because the accumulator register is pointing to something of interest to you, something you control. So let me try that from a different perspective. In like USAPT or free exploitation, remember you're trying to replace memory that's been prematurely freed with something that you control as the attacker. And what ends up happening a lot of times is, let's say, for example, the accumulator register is pointing to data that you control out on the heap, and that's where you put your ROP chain. Well, you want to utilize the stack pointer because the stack pointer has those three powerful instructions, push, pop, and ret. They don't have that for the accumulator register. So what you can do is execute the instruction, exchange ESP, and then whatever register you want to swap it with, EAX in this case. And that way, the stack pointer points to the memory you control out on the heap, and the accumulator register points to the stack. And then when you ret, you're returning to the pointers, the ROP gadget pointers that you have out on the heap. So that's a true stack pivot. There's another pivot where if the stack pointer is pointing to an area in memory that you don't control, and you have control of the instruction pointer, you might be able to add or subtract a large number of bytes to the stack pointer to get it back into an area you do control. And that's what we're going to end up doing in this particular exploit. So just visualizing a stack pivot here. So on the right, you see it says fake vtable. That's a virtual function table that's used during virtual function calls in C++. And so after the pivot, you can see what's happened. So before the pivot, the accumulator register would point to the fake virtual function table that the attacker controls on the heap, and the stack pointer points where it's supposed to on the stack. So when you do the pivot, you're exchanging those two registers, and now the stack pointer points out on the heap, and when you return to the pointers to your gadgets. So pretty neat way. And just to point it out, there's this protection that came out in Windows 8 called Anti-ROP. And I think we call it now stack pivot protection. And what it does is before you're permitted to call a critical function like virtual alloc or virtual protect, it first validates that the stack pointer is pointing where it's supposed to be on the stack. And it knows how to do that because it can check the TIB for the thread that you're under the context for to see if the stack high and stack low limits, if the stack pointer is pointing between that in that range. If it's not pointing in that range, it's been stolen away, and it will terminate the process as a security control. So kind of a clever control, but easily defeated, because what you can do is imagine if over on the right there, that was my fake virtual function table with all my gadget pointers. What if I simply have the code execute that says copy what the stack pointer is pointing to and write it to what the accumulator register is pointing to? And then copy what the stack pointer is pointing to plus whatever number of bytes to the next gadget and write it to EAX plus 4, plus 8, plus 12. And you're basically moving the ROP chain from dynamic memory over to the stack. And then you pivot the stack pointer back over to the stack where it belongs and then continue execution. Then when that little check occurs to make sure the stack pointer is pointing where it should be, all is well. So tools to help build gadgets, we already talked about Mona, and we're going to use Mona to generate a ROP chain today. There's also Ropper by Sasha Shira. There's Ida Sploiter from Peter Kaczerginski. There's Palm Tools, Rope Me, and there are other ones as well. There's a lot of ROP gadget finders that were written out there and available for free, and there's also ones that put together entire ROP chains for you, like Mona, and that's what we'll use soon. So in summary for the module, before we move to the demo slash exercise, we looked at a couple different ways to turn off DEP if it's an old enough operating system, or utilize return-oriented programming to change permissions in memory. So let's move on to this exercise. What you're going to do before you go and get started on this or listen to the demo walkthrough, there's two things. The exercise here has you use a script that I already wrote, an exploit that I already wrote that incorporates or includes a ROP chain. And what it's going to have you do is set a breakpoint on the first gadget, and you're going to walk through the execution of the ROP chain and just kind of make sure everything is digesting and you understand all of it. And you may run into a problem, you may not run into a problem. And if you run into a problem, the exercise shows you how to go about fixing it. So that's what you're going to do in this section. In the extended hours or boot camp or whatever you want to call it, at the end of this book, the challenge will have you generate your own ROP chain and replace the ROP chain, that an exploit that I already wrote for you. So you're going to do it from scratch a bit more versus using the one that I wrote for you and that you would trace. So keep that in mind. What we want to do now, though, and even if you're going to try this on your own prior to listening to the walkthrough, listen to this first part until I get to the debugger, because I'm going to walk through what all the ROP gadgets are doing. So first off, we're going to go on Windows 10 and make sure DEP is enabled for that process. So let me do that now before I forget. So we'll bring up the control panel. We'll go to System. We'll go to System, Advanced, Settings, DEP. And let's remove the exception for Blaze. So we apply that. Now DEP is on. So we're good there. Go back out to the slide. All right, so the completed exploit is in your Blaze files folder in your day 5 or book 5 on your Windows 10 VM, as everything else was. And what I did initially was when I was looking for the perfect vulnerable application to use for exercises in this book, in this day, I went around ExploitDB and found Blaze, right? We already talked about that. So what I found was the exploit that was posted up there did have a ROP chain in it, and it disabled or changed permissions for Windows 7 32-bit. When I then ran that exploit on Windows 7 64-bit, it failed. When I ran it on Windows 8, it failed. On Windows 10, it failed. And so I had to figure out what was wrong with it and how to port it so it was able to work across the different operating systems in case you're running it on one versus another. And that's what we're gonna talk about, that process, which is quite easy, when we get to the appropriate slide. So you're using the completed script that I wrote that should work out of the box. You may encounter a problem, and I'm going to talk about that problem when we get to the appropriate slide here in a moment.